Turn your Bible with me this morning, please, to the book of Proverbs, chapter 29. Proverbs, chapter 29. Bob Collins from Federal Way, Washington, wrote this story, and it was recorded in a national magazine. He said, "I've been a cop for about 14 years, and the thing about being a cop is that we're always prepared. That's what our training is. You stay in control of the situation, whether it's a riot or a desperate guy trying to knock over a gas station. As a cop, you better be in control, because if you're not, the criminal will be." But then came the night I learned what it was like to be on the victim side of a crime when the situation was completely out of my control. A time when it was quite evident that only God was in control. Just shortly after I fell into a deep sleep, I heard my wife Denise say, "Is something wrong, sweetheart?" There was a nervous edge to her voice. I opened my eyes to find our 17-year-old son, John, standing in the doorway of our bedroom. Uneasily, he replied, "Sort of." He and his 15-year-old brother, Bo, had been at a meeting of our church's youth group that night, and my first thought was, maybe he's gotten in a car wreck. John looked behind him. Bo appeared, and with him was a young man wearing a hooded sweatshirt tied tightly around his face. He had his arm around Bo, and he had a gun pressed against Bo's head. My mind raced. This was what police call a home invasion robbery. It's much riskier than a burglary, and criminals who take such chances usually choose a house where they think they'll find significant valuables. We only had the usual TV and VCRs and the like. Were they going to believe us when we told them? What would they do then? If only I could get to my gun, I thought. Maybe I could reach it. No, that would be stupid. Just do whatever they say. I knew in home invasion robberies, there's a real danger the victims will be seriously injured or killed, usually because they resist in some way or panic. Another face appeared in the doorway, half hidden by a surgical mask. I reminded myself not to look at them directly. If a criminal thinks you can identify him, that gives him another reason to kill you. Lord, I prayed, protect us. Here we were, the four of us, trapped in one room with two robbers. The only one missing was Nicole, our 12-year-old daughter. She was asleep in her room next to ours. What would happen when they found her? I prayed, God, please be with Nicole. I feared greatly for the safety of my family. Any moment we could be dead. "Get on the floor," growled the man with a gun. I stretched face down in the narrow space between the wall and the bed. I got a glimpse of the gun. It looked like a .38 or a .357 Magnum. Deadly weapon. As I dropped my head, I heard the sound of duct tape being unrolled. The fellow without the gun taped my hands behind my back, my ankles, and slapped tape over my mouth. They were both wearing disposable latex gloves. They had come prepared. Someone jammed a pillow on my head. This is it, I thought. He's going to shoot me and wants to protect his clothes from my spattering blood. He piled on another pillow. I held my breath, but no shot came. One of the men yelled at Denise, my wife, "Put your head down." His partner taped her while he continued to threaten to kill us. More sounds of tearing duct tape as he bound my sons. One of the robbers came close to me. He seemed confident and controlled. "Are you expecting anybody?" he asked. I tried to speak through the duct tape, but I couldn't make him understand. He yanked the tape off my mouth and shoved the pillows on my head again. "No," I said, desperately hoping Nicole wouldn't be waked by the commotion and walk in. "Where's your wallet?" "I'm not sure," I said through the pillows. "Where's your jewelry?" shouted his partner. "In the top drawer," she said. I could hear them shuffling through the dresser. A moment later, he snapped at my wife, "If you don't let me have that ring, I'll cut off your finger." Through the duct tape, she said, "Twist, twist it." He did. It wouldn't budge. All this time, I could hear the man with the gun cocking the hammer as if he planned to use it at any moment. Then I heard another man's voice in the hall. "There's a girl asleep in here." My heart sank. They had found Nicole. He cursed at my daughter and ordered her into our room. "Get on the bed," snarled the man who was clearly the leader. Nicole was a spirited, self-confident girl, and I prayed she wouldn't resist. Lord, please give her a cool head. Nicole seemed to be complying. One of the men said, "Don't shoot her yet." I heard the rip of tape while they bound her. Desperation consumed me. Despite my police training, always to be prepared, I was really utterly helpless. Then a new fear overtook me. What would happen if they discovered my badge? They'd know I was a cop. They'd have even more reason to kill me and my family. Lord, I prayed, keep us safe. One of them came back. He'd found my bank card in my wallet. He demanded the PIN number. I spelled it out. He got it wrong. I said it again and again. And finally, he repeated it back right. He said, "You better be telling the truth because one of us is going to use it. If it's wrong, we're going to kill you." There was silence for a while, except for the sound of the hammer of the gun cocking and the labored breathing of my family with duct tape over their mouths. Just then, one of the men strode back into the room. His footsteps stopped when he was standing over me. There was a long, silent pause. "So, how long have you been a cop, man?" "My badge. Next will be my gun. A 40 caliber Glock with 15 hollow point bullets. The perfect weapon to kill us. Registered to me, it could make their crime that much harder to trace." "Where's your gun?" he demanded angrily. My mind reeled. Can I stall them? What will they believe? What will they believe? No, I have to tell the truth. I opened my mouth to tell them where it was. It should be in the dresser, I stammered. He looked, and it wasn't there. "Mister, no more games," he snarled. I heard the other man cock the hammer of his revolver again. I really couldn't remember. I told him to try the closet, but it wasn't there either. He was getting madder and madder. Then I remembered I'd been at a training session and I'd left it locked in the car. He went to look. The man with the gun kept clicking the hammer of his weapon. I heard it click, click. I'd better not be wrong again. "Got it," the man yelled from the hall. Suddenly the leader said calmly, "We'll be leaving soon. In about 10 minutes we'll call the police and they'll come and release you." This is it, I thought. They're saying that so we won't try any last-minute heroics and they can slaughter us like sheep. It had to be the worst moment of my life. I was a husband. I was a father. I was a policeman. On all counts, I owed it to my wife and children to protect them, and there was nothing I could do, nothing at all. Proverbs chapter 29, verse 25. Would you read it with me out loud, please, everyone? "The fear of man bringeth a snare, but whoso putteth his trust in the Lord shall be safe." One more time. "The fear of man bringeth a snare, but whoso putteth his trust in the Lord shall be safe." If there is any one verse that deals with the subject of fear that has had a powerful effect on my life, it is that verse. Now, there are many hundreds of verses in the Bible about fear and being afraid, the fear of man, the fear of the Lord, the fear of God, and so on. But this is surely one of the most important verses you could ever memorize for your life. "The fear of man bringeth a snare, but whoso putteth his trust in the Lord shall be safe." Which of us here has not experienced fear at some time or other? In a city in Germany, police rushed to a building where residents reported hearing screaming, and they found out it was a dentist office where a 10-year-old was having his cavity filled. Which of us has not experienced fear of some sort or the other this very week? Some ladies were working in the office. I won't call their names, but one was my daughter and the other was one of the older ladies in our church that I'm looking at right now, and then the other was the tape secretary, and so you can guess at who it was. And they were all in there busy working, and a little tiny mouse, I saw it was that big, a little tiny mouse came running in the office, and somebody said to my daughter after it's over with, because she screamed, she went, "Ah!" And the lady said to her, "I didn't know you could scream. I just found it out." And Then it went running in my office, and for some reason, nobody wanted to go into my office the rest of the day. And the folks I'm supposed to counsel after church today, I don't know whether you're going to want to go in my office or not. I haven't seen it since. They said it went in there. But which of us has not experienced fear of some sort or the other? This lady, April Kuzo, writes, "One of my greatest fears is that of centipedes. Those hideous creatures sometimes called 100-legged worms." And then she says, "By the way, do you know why centipedes don't play football? Because by the time they put on their shoes, it's time to go home." Or what do you get if you cross a centipede with a parrot? A walkie-talkie. How many centipedes does it take to change a light bulb? Just one, because many hands make light work. All kidding aside, I guess if they didn't run so fast on all those little legs, they wouldn't bother me so much. There are two places in our house where we most often meet them, the basement or the bathroom. I was headed into the bathroom to brush my teeth one summer evening when I looked down and saw a huge, hairy centipede in the middle of the bathroom floor. Being barefoot, I quickly decided against stepping on it. It started to run quickly toward my bare toes. So I shrieked and started to back up. It increased its speed, and so did I. It also increased the volume of my screams. My husband came running toward me to see what was wrong and quickly stepped on my attacker. He was so sweet not to make fun or laugh at me, but to calm my fears and quickly dispense of the little corpse. Fears. All of us have experienced them at some time or other, and there are some healthy fears. But there is an unhealthy fear that brings things into your life you don't want there. And I'm really speaking this morning on the subject of what fear does. Tonight, the Lord willing, I'll speak on the subject how to conquer fear and develop courage. But that verse, Proverbs 29:25, "The fear of man bringeth a snare." What does it mean? The word fear there means anxiety. Quaking, trembling, extreme anxiety, anxious care. It's used in 1 Samuel 14:15 where it says, "There was trembling in the host, an army that was full of fear." The fear of man is referring, of course, to any individual man or mankind as a whole. For many people, it could be the fear of their peers. Did you ever stop to think that in many cases peer pressure isn't really anything but fear pressure? We are simply afraid of what those around us are going to think if we do a certain thing or don't do a certain thing. The fear of man bringeth, it gives or produces a snare. And that is a trap, a bait, or a lure. But whoso putteth his trust in the Lord shall be safe. Whoso putteth his trust, his confidence, his security, his faith in the Lord shall be safe. He will be placed inaccessibly high by God, too high for capture. Fear of man is the absence of faith. Where there's fear, there's no faith. Where there's faith, there's no fear. The fear of man bringeth the snare. As I looked through the Bible, it appeared that there were actually several different possible snares that could trap a person who has the fear of man. The first one, the snare that fear causes is to cause us to focus on negative things rather than positive things. Would you turn back in your Bible to the book of Numbers, chapter 13. Now, you probably noticed that in my messages, I often refer to this chapter. It's because the things that happened there were key, pivotal things that provide principles for all of us. But this chapter also changed the course of Israel's history. Numbers, chapter 13. Look at verse 27. What has happened here is that they have come out of Egypt, they have crossed the Red Sea, they are at Kadesh Barnea, and it is time to enter the Promised Land. And so they send out 12 spies to check out the land. They are not going there to find out whether they should go or not. That is the reason God brought them out of Egypt. By the way, the reason God saved you from your sin was not to get you, not to just take you out of Egypt and drop you. He means for you to grow. He means for you to experience the victory of the promised land. He wants you to grow in Him. He wants you to take all the land that He has for you. So here they are. The spies have gone out, and now they bring back their report after checking out the land. Verse 27, they told him and said, "We came into the land whither thou sendest us, and surely it floweth with milk and honey, and this is the fruit of it." And this fruit they're carrying is really incredible. It's described back there in verse 23. And they came into the brook of Eshcol and cut down from thence a branch with one cluster of grapes. And they bare it between two upon a staff. And they brought of the pomegranates and the figs. Can you imagine, folks? One cluster of grapes so large that it took two men with a staff between them to carry one cluster of grapes. I was at one of our men's house the other day and was looking at his grapes, and he had a couple of pretty good sized clusters. They were about like that. But any child here could have carried that one little cluster. But here was a cluster of grapes. I was in an antique store this week with one of my grandchildren, and we saw this little decorative item. It was about this big. And it looked like grapes, and the grapes were about that big, so it was about like that. And he said, "Papa, do you think that was the size those grapes were that those fellows brought back from the promised land?" And I said, "Yes, sir, it probably was, but as I thought about it, they were probably much larger than that. One cluster of grapes, so large, so heavy. These grapes may have been the size of oranges or apples. And so large and heavy, it took two men to carry it." And so they're saying, "Wow, this really is incredible. This is the fruit of it." Verse 28, "Nevertheless." Now listen to me, when God has something for you to do, you better watch out for your neverthelesses. "Nevertheless, the people be strong that dwell in the land, and the cities are walled and very great. And moreover, we saw the children of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites dwell in the mountains. The Canaanites dwell by the sea, by the coast of Jordan. And Caleb," thank God for Caleb, "still the people before Moses and said, 'Let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it.' But the men that went up with him said, 'We be not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we.' And they brought up an evil report of the land which they had searched unto the children of Israel, saying, 'The land through which we have gone to search it is a land that eateth up the inhabitants thereof.'" Sorry, you know, I've never seen land that ate up the inhabitants. Have you? "And all the people that we saw in it are men of a great stature." Now, what is happening here? What does fear do? Fear causes you to focus on what you can't do instead of what you can do. It causes you to focus on what you cannot do for God instead of what you're supposed to do for God. See this. They could have taken that land. It is a fact. They could have defeated the giants. They could have experienced the thrill of victory. They could have known the joy of entering the promised land. But they didn't get to do it. Satan laid a trap for them. The trap was not the giants over there. The trap was simply fear. Chapter 14, verse 9. "Only rebel not ye against the Lord, neither fear ye the people of the land." This is Joshua and Caleb talking to the people. "For they are bread for us. Their defense is departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Fear them not." And in my Bible, I drew a line right after that, because that was their last chance. At that point, If they responded wrongly, they were going to spend 40 years wandering in the wilderness, and that is exactly what happened. The next statement says, all the congregation bade stone them with stones, and the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle, and God essentially said, that is it, you're done. Listen to me. The negatives of life that stand in the way of us doing what God has for us to do are not our responsibility. That's God's responsibility. God promised them the land. How to defeat the giants was up to God. If they would do what they were supposed to do, then God would take care of it. They could have had victory. Now you notice right away here that all fear is not the same. In fact, some fear is healthy fear. I read an article just 2 weeks ago. Clipped this out of July 21st, 2007 paper. It's actually sort of humorous. Gainesville, Georgia. It says, it's a bad idea to burglarize a place marked canine training facility. Police dog handlers arrived Wednesday at the abandoned nursing home where they hold training sessions, and they discovered two men and a woman dismantling the building's copper pipes and wiring. The sheriff said, when the officers arrived, the three dropped their tools and ran, and that was their second mistake. The sergeant said, for anyone to try to run from a whole unit of canines, it's just a no-win situation. Pamela Puckett, 37, quickly surrendered. Mark Black, 18, was tracked to a trash bin behind a nearby convenience store. Paul Perry, 39, was treated for a superficial dog bite just below the buttocks after his arrest, authorities said. Signs outside the Northern Georgia facility warn caution. Gainesville Police Department canine training facility, keep out. You know what? There should have been some fear on their part, don't you think? Somebody should have said, you know, what if they really train police dogs here? I wonder what's going to happen to us. But they didn't have the fear they needed. The Bible talks about a very good fear. Psalm 19 says, the fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. It's very proper, very wholesome, very needed. Psalm 111 verse 10 says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Proverbs 1:7, fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. That's the reason you want your children to fear God. Because the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom and the beginning of knowledge. Psalm 15:4 teaches that special honor is on them that fear the Lord. Psalm 25:14 says, the secret of the Lord is with them that fear Him. God reveals His greatest truths to those who fear Him, respect Him, honor Him. Psalm 31:19 teaches God's goodness is laid up for those that fear Him. Psalm 34:7 says, the angel of the Lord encampeth round about them that fear Him and delivereth them. Proper fear of God is one big reason lost people get saved. Listen to me very carefully. Now, how many here are saved and you know you're saved? Lift your hand. Thank you. You can put it back down. I gave that so you could look at your own heart for just a second and say, was there a time in my life when I realized I was a lost sinner on my way to hell, repented of my sin and got saved? And folks, I'm not just talking about saying a little prayer every once in a while. And I'm not talking about just going to church. And I'm not just talking about being baptized. The Bible says that there'll be many people who will say, Lord, Lord, did we not do all these religious things? And He said, I will say to them, depart from me, ye workers of iniquity, I never knew you. The question is not, do you think you're going to heaven? The question is, does God know you're going to heaven because you've done what He said you had to do? God is the one who spells out what you have to do to go to heaven, and He spelled that out as a matter of repenting of your sin and trusting Jesus as your Savior. Now, could I tell you one reason I got saved as a boy? Because I was afraid I'd die and go to hell. And did you know that is not a wrong fear? There are folks in our day who say, well, you know, the preachers, they'll dangle hell out there in front of people. Well, let's see what God does. Matthew 10:28. And fear not them which kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul. In other words, don't fear man, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. Did you notice that there is a strong connection between the fear of God and hell, that God is God? Now, I don't suggest when you look up toward heaven right now that you see God like somebody with lightning bolts about to hit you with it. I think you ought to look up and see a loving Heavenly Father who loves you, cares for you, has done everything He can to take you to heaven. On the other hand, if you sin against His love, if you trample upon His love, His grace, His forgiveness, and say, it's no big deal, I don't need it, then you better stop and recognize that He is indeed God, who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. And the word destroy there doesn't mean annihilate. That's not what it means in this verse. It doesn't mean you just be wiped out forever. You just go there and you burn up. That is not the meaning. What it means is to render lost and useless to God or good. That is the meaning. You're lost, you're useless to God and to good for all eternity. In Luke chapter 16, you have the rich man in hell. He has some form on him. He left behind his earthly body, but he has some kind of form. And he is thirsty. He is begging for a drink of water. He is talking. He is begging for mercy. He's begging for somebody to go back and preach to his brothers. Can I tell you? I know in our day that folks are making fun of hell and saying the preachers who preach about hell are out of step with the times. But if you believe the Bible, you open it up, just read it for yourself. Don't take anybody else's suggestion. Just read it for yourself. You don't need to come with any preconceived ideas. You can't get away from the fact that the Bible teaches there is a hell. A real, literal, fiery, burning hell. That's what the Bible teaches. And so there's that man in Luke chapter 16. Look at me. Listen to me. From the time when it talks about destroying both soul and body in hell, it's saying there will never be a time when you do not have some state of aliveness and awareness, and yet you are useless to God for all eternity. You're useless to anybody. Comas are for here, not for eternity. Death and destruction is for the earthly body here, but not for your soul. God made a part of you to always feel and touch. God made a part of you to never die. Dr. Bob Jones Sr. said as a boy that he was walking along the road one day and just kicking up the dust in Alabama, where he was raised, just a little boy kicking up the dust. And he said, I was just thinking, and it dawned on me, I've got to live somewhere forever. He says, one of the greatest thoughts of my whole life, I've got to live somewhere forever, either in heaven or in hell. You know, people who take their own lives and say, I'm going to end all my misery. If they're lost, they don't end their misery. They begin their misery. That is when the misery really starts. There is a proper fear and there is a wrong fear that causes you to focus on the negative rather than the positive. I wonder how many people have never won a soul because their fear of man caused them to focus on the negative rather than the positive. I wonder how many missionaries have been called but never made it to the mission field because of their fear of churches and pastors and deputation and culture shock. And that's all very real. I'm not making fun of anybody. I wonder how many have never worked on a bus route because of their fear of man, have never taught a Sunday school class because of their fear of man. You say, well, how could somebody be afraid of teaching a group of little boys or little girls? It was the Apostle Peter who cursed and swore and denied Jesus because he was afraid of a little girl who said, you're one of them. I know you are. How many people have never worked in a nursery because of their fear of a dirty diaper? There are people who don't tithe because they're afraid somebody will criticize them for it or they won't be able to pay their bills. And so what does this fear do? It causes us to focus on the negative rather than the positive. The second thing it does, it causes us to exaggerate the negative. Fear not only focuses on the negative, it exaggerates it. Look at chapter 13, verse 32 and 33. At the end of verse 32, it says, "This is a land that eats up the inhabitants. These are men of great stature." Verse 33, "And there we saw the giants, the sons of Anak, which come of the giants, and we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, and so we were in their sight." Now, I'm sorry, hold on here. No man is a grasshopper compared to any other man. Now, it is certainly true that somebody may be small compared to somebody who is tall. But to say you are a grasshopper, they are exaggerating the negative. I'm 1,000 times bigger than a grasshopper. But no man is 1,000 times bigger than any other man. How tall was David when he faced Goliath? Goliath was 9'6" tall. If David was short as a 16-year-old, we think he was about 16 years old. If he was short, he was probably 5'6", 5'8" at that time. And so Goliath was not even twice as tall as he was. No man is 1,000 times bigger than any other man. But how do we exaggerate the negative? Here's a child laying in bed at night, and the room is dark. They haven't gone to sleep yet, and the child starts hearing noises. At first he thinks it's just the wind. But then it sounds worse than that. It must be a man. No, it's not just a man, it's a big man. It's not just a big man, it's a monster. It's not just any monster, it's a three-eyed monster. It's not just a three-eyed monster, it's a three-eyed monster with horns and a tail. And what was it to start with? It was probably just some creaking of the house. Have you ever been in a church at night? I've been up here lots of nights. Last night at 10:30, I'm back in my office studying and I hear this noise. I definitely heard a noise. It sounded like somebody had walked in the office. And I'm back in the, way back in there, the inner sanctum. And so I jump up out of my chair. I don't want somebody walking up behind me while I'm studying. Not in the middle of the night. And I jump out of my chair. I go walking in my office, and then there's the other office out there. And I said, "Somebody out there? Who's out there? Anybody out there?" And I walked in the other room, and I felt a little chill go down my back. I said, "Anybody here? Anybody here?" And I don't know, maybe it was that mouse, but I didn't see anybody or anything. And I finally said, "Oh, well," going back and said, "You know, do y'all know what I'm talking about? Fear exaggerates things. It puts everything out of proportion." How many of y'all ever got called to the principal's office? All the way there you were thinking, "What can I do and how can I get out of it? What did I do? How can I get out?" And after you got there, you found out you didn't do anything. They just wanted to give you a form to fill out. I read a story about a girl who had gotten in trouble a bunch of times in school. And she thought she'd been doing good. And she got called to the principal's office. And all the way there, she's thinking, "What did I do? What happened? What? Oh, no. And she got there and the principal met her and said, "You know what, Sally? you're probably wondering if you did anything. I just want to tell you, you hadn't done anything bad, but you've been doing some really good things. I just called you here to tell you the good things you've been doing. I've been blessed by you, and I just want to tell you about it. Remember when Elijah ran from Jezebel? Now, was Elijah really in any danger? The God who sent down fire from heaven to consume the sacrifice on Mount Carmel that had just happened, it had just been an incredible, incredible victory. Surely, God could have taken care of Jezebel with one little lightning bolt if he'd have wanted to. But fear puts everything out of proportion, and Elijah ran for his life and then fell down and prayed to die. Here's a husband and wife having problems, and then the fear of what if gets involved, and everything really gets blown out of proportion. Lots of anger, lots of fights in homes between husbands and wives and parents and children are because, well, but I think you might have done this. And you exaggerate the negative, the fear of what might have happened. Suddenly I've seen homes blow apart literally for nothing, for no reason whatsoever. There was no cause whatsoever. In fact, I've been asked the question before. Pastor, several months ago I was asked this question. Pastor, what is the number one reason for divorce? And my answer to them was this. The number one cause of divorce is simply somebody gets it in their mind and won't give it up. That's it. They reach the point, whether it is serious or not serious, they reach the point that they give up, they want a divorce, and that's it. Doesn't matter what it was, doesn't matter how serious it was or how non-serious it was, doesn't matter. Things get blown all out of proportion. A problem is as big as you make it. If you keep making it bigger and bigger in your mind, it will keep growing bigger and bigger in your mind. There are men who have been out of work, and, you know, there are men who have been out of work, and they sat back and they said, you know, God's on the throne, He's going to work this out, and they seem to just go right through it. And I'm not criticizing anybody. This can happen to anybody. I'm just explaining to you what happens. I'm explaining to you how fear exaggerates the negative things. There are other men who have been out of work, and, man, they about go bonkers. What am I going to do? How am I going to pay my bills? The exaggeration of the negative. There's a really key verse here. Listen to this. Psalm 53:5. There were they in great fear where no fear was. Have you ever been deathly afraid and there was absolutely nothing at all to be afraid of? My daddy, years ago, 1979, he used to send me a bulletin every week, and occasionally he'd clip illustrations out of the paper, and he sent this to me in 1979. Peggy Hunter, 34, and her daughter Jennifer, 12, were sleeping in a tent at a church camp in Colorado. They were awakened by a shot and a terrible scream, and then they heard somebody say, "Don't shoot him in the head." Then they heard more shots. It sounded like mass murder, and they knew they were next. They bit a hole in their tent and fled into the forest. For 2 full weeks, they ran through the forest. They ate berries and roots. They covered themselves with dirt when they slept. They were constantly pursued by men in rough clothing with dogs. They finally emerged at a highway. Sick, almost delirious, a motorist gave them a ride home where they found out that the shot was a raccoon being killed so it could be tested for rabies. The scream was the raccoons. The reason they were screaming, don't shoot him in the head was because they needed his head to check for the rabies. The other gunfire they heard was fireworks. The pursuers were search teams out looking for the mother and daughter who they thought had been kidnapped by a motorcycle gang in the area. And the whole fear was useless, negative, and exaggerated. The whole fear was of fear itself. During World War II, Hitler created what was known as the Blitzkrieg. He equipped his slow Stutka dive bombers with special whistlers that gave out a bone-chilling shriek as the planes would dive. He put similar things on the bombs themselves, and the shrieks of the planes as they dove would frighten people on the ground so badly they would freeze in their tracks. In the London bombings of 1943, 200 people died in bomb shelters without a bruise or a scratch on them. They died of fear. I hate this story. I was hesitant to even use it, but it shows what fear does. Matilda Crabtree, 14, of West Monroe, Louisiana, used to try to scare her father as a joke. This article says, but this week she made a tragic miscalculation. She had planned to sleep over at a friend's, and instead she stayed home, hid in a closet, and then made scary noises when her parents arrived. Her father grabbed a pistol. She shouted, "Boo," and his shot hit her in the neck, and her final words were, "I love you, Daddy." Fear of man exaggerates the negative. Why didn't those parents say, "That's my child," instead of saying, "That's my enemy"? They were afraid. What or who are you afraid of right now? Satan wants to exaggerate the negative in your life, especially if it will keep you from accomplishing the will of God for your life. And I'm already into my next point. The fear of man causes us to act irrationally. Numbers chapter 14, verse 10. Look at it again. But all the congregation bade stone them with stones, and the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle of the congregation before all the children of Israel. They were going to kill Joshua and Caleb, their brethren, their leaders. So many times in the Bible, the fear of man caused somebody to do something ridiculous. In Genesis chapter 20, Abraham was afraid of Abimelech and put his wife Sarah in terrible danger because of it. In Genesis chapter 20, verse 11, listen what it says. And Abraham said, "Because I thought surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will slay me for my wife's sake." He thought the fear of God wasn't there, so the fear of man became so great, he thought they're going to kill me to get her. In Luke 22, Peter cursed and swore and denied he knew the Lord because of his fear of a girl. But years later, Peter was still wrestling with the fear of man. Paul, in Galatians chapter 2, verse 11 and 12, said, "But when Peter was come to Antioch, I withstood him to the face. For before certain came from James, he did eat with the Gentiles. But when they were come, he withdrew and separated himself." In other words, Peter accepted the Gentiles till the Jews showed up. Then Peter became prejudiced again. Hey, there's something wrong with friends who are friends until other friends show up. In 1 Samuel 15, King Saul had been given specific step-by-step instructions concerning what to do about the Amalekites. But in verse 24, Saul said to Samuel, "I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord because I feared the people." Now, don't misunderstand me here. I think it's a sorry leader who doesn't seek and listen to the counsel of his people. On the other hand, it's also a sorry leader who fears people more than he fears God. So he disobeys God trying to please people. And that may be a father in the home, a pastor in the church, a mayor, a governor, a congressman, a president. It may be anybody like that who has such a terrific fear of man that they don't obey God. I was raised around some powerful preachers, and one of those I heard preach many occasions was Dr. J. Harold Smith. Dr. Smith went to heaven just a few years ago now, and he was 90 or 91 when he went to heaven and just preached all over the country, did a tremendous job for many years. But he, as a younger man, fought against the liquor traffic in the South, especially in the area where he lived. He was captured once. A group of men captured him and took him into a pool hall. He'd been preaching against pool halls and liquor and against the liquor in the pool halls. And they lifted him up, set him on top of a pool table and said, "Preach to us." They were making fun of him. They had guns pointing at him when they said, "Preach to us or we're going to kill you." He said, I'll be glad to preach to you. You don't have to threaten me to preach. And he started preaching. He had on cowboy boots, and as he preached, he dug his heels into the pool table, kicked the pool table, scraped the pool table, and destroyed the pool table. And they said, "What are you doing?" He said, "If I'm going to heaven, I'm taking one pool table with me." Now there's a man who did not fear man. He feared God more than he feared man. A husband once came to the home of a pastor to complain about his wife. After listening to the man's complaints, the preacher said, "You're right, you're right, you're absolutely right." Hours so later, the wife came to tell her side of the story, and after listening to her, the preacher said, "You're right, you're right, you're absolutely right." When the lady left, the preacher's wife said, "I can't believe you. You told the husband he was right, then you told the wife she was right. I think you're a coward. I think you're afraid to say what you really believe. I think you refuse to take a stand." The preacher listened for a minute, then said, "Honey, you're right, you're right, you're absolutely right." Why don't Christians stand alone on the job? Because they're afraid. They're afraid of being mocked or laughed at or persecuted or hated. I looked up the phrase, "not be afraid" in the Bible, and it occurs 13 times. I've seen people, listen to me, I've seen teenagers. Have you seen this thing, the sign that says, "No fear," N-O-F-E-A-R? No fear. I always want to ask, what kind of fear are you talking about? Because there is a right kind of a fear. That no fear they're talking about typically epitomizes the recklessness of youth who want to push the envelope and do anything, and they don't care about anybody or anything. And they overlook the tragedy of lives broken or lives prematurely ended. Could I tell you, in the eternal scheme of things, it would be much better for this generation to scrap the haughty attitude of N-O fear and replace it with K-N-O-W fear, referring to the fear of an almighty God whose lives are in His hand. Christians could put N-O fear and then put Psalm 56:11 after it. "In God have I put my trust. I will not be afraid what man can do unto me." Most people are not afraid when they ought to be, and they are afraid when they shouldn't be. It happens an awful lot. A man's on his first day on the job, and he thinks to himself, "I don't really know the job yet, and I need these people to help me learn it, and I don't want them to think I'm weird or something. I want to be accepted and liked and talked to and not ostracized, and I don't want the guys whispering and laughing at me behind my back. Lord, I know I ought to let them know right up front I'm a Christian, but can I be a Christian and just not say anything?" So he says nothing. You remember what Matthew 10:32 says? "Whosoever therefore shall confess me before men, him will I confess also before my Father which is in heaven." So the opportunity to stand comes. Maybe it's in a discussion about some dirty movie or some music group. Maybe somebody uses God's name in vain and he just grins. Maybe some lady walks by and some lewd remark is made and he just lets it go. Maybe a filthy joke is told and he listens and he laughs. Maybe a dirty magazine is pulled out. Maybe any of those things. But once that chance comes and your stand isn't taken, then you feel guilty because you did not keep the testimony of Christ. You did not stand for Him. And then the fear of man increases. And you feel weaker. You think to yourself, "I've already blown it now. They'll really make fun of me if I speak up now. And so silence and fear rules and reigns until, like Lot, you vex your righteous soul with the filthy conversation of the wicked. And if you're not careful, it won't be long until you have compromised everything completely. In Deuteronomy 1:17, God warned about perverting justice because of the fear of man. "Ye shall not respect persons in judgment, but ye shall hear the small as well as the great. Ye shall not be afraid of the face of man, for the judgment is God's." In three different passages in the Gospel of John, 7:13, 9:22, and 12:42, people did not confess Jesus because of fear of the Jews. They're worried about what the scribes and Pharisees and religious leaders were going to say about them. How many people today don't get saved because they're afraid of what somebody might say about them? How many people don't get baptized because, well, if I get baptized, people will make fun of me? So the fear causes us to focus on the negative instead of the positive, exaggerate the negative, act irrationally. And then the fear of man causes us to lose great opportunities of life. Chapter 14, verse 23, God said, "Surely they shall not see the land which I swear unto their fathers, neither shall any of them that provoke me see it." Verse 28, "Say unto them, as truly as I live, saith the Lord, as ye have spoken in mine ears, so will I do to you." And that means they get to wander and die in the wilderness. Stay with me, people. Listen. Your fear can stop you so long that you lose your opportunity to do what God wants you to do. I've seen parents who failed to raise godly children because of fear of what their family was going to say if they did what they had to do, or fear of what their friends were going to say. Several years ago, I remember, and this has been over 20 years ago, but I can still remember this clearly, how I felt there was, I really felt strongly it's something I needed to do, but I was afraid of what people in the church might say. And so I didn't do it. And later on, I paid dearly for that mistake. There have been times that I didn't deal with some problem because of the fear of man. Then those problems simply got worse. I was talking to a missionary this week. And in the conversation, it came up that he was a member of another church. And now, or he had been a member of another church. Now he was in this more conservative church, Bible-believing church. And I said to him, "Can I ask you a question? I feel like I really need to know. Has that other church really gone liberal? Has that really happened? You were in that church?" He said, "Yes, Brother Davis." And he said, "I was in that church for years." And he said, "When I started to go to the mission field and they found the mission board I was going to be a part of, found out what church I was from, they said, 'You're in a liberal church. We can't even take you in that church.'" He said, "That is when it shocked me to cause me to realize the church has gone too far." And he said, "I realized I had to leave." And I said, "Did you ever go talk to the pastor?" He said, "I went to talk to him several times, but he said, the honest truth is this. He's afraid to, he told me, I just don't like to confront people." And I said to him, "You know, I don't like to confront things either, but if what I've learned over the years is, if you don't do it, it can get so bad you'll really wish you dealt with it sooner." And what's happened now is many good Bible-believing families have left that church. And this missionary I was talking to said, I think that pastor's starting to wake up now. But he said, it looks like it's going to be horrendous what he's going to have to deal with. There comes a time when if you don't witness to that lost relative or friend or neighbor, the next time you decide may be too late. There's a lady in our church here, Nora Peters, who was out in San Antonio, Texas, witnessing to somebody. And it's like the Holy Spirit impressed her, witness to that young man. And she didn't do it right then. And by the next afternoon, I believe it was, that she went to witness to him, his family was already making arrangements for his funeral. He had taken his own life a few hours before. Maybe you need to get saved. Maybe you know you need to get baptized, but you're afraid of what somebody might say. Can I tell you, you can wait too long. You can put it off so long that what are you going to do now? I mean, it's a horrible thing. What are you going to do now? I began with this story of this policeman by the name of Bob Collins, whose home had been invaded. He said, "I owed it to my wife and children to protect them. There was nothing I could do, nothing. Then I reminded myself that God is bigger than all my fears. They're all taped up. Their home has been ransacked. Now that everything was truly out of my control, I had to draw on God's power. I said, God, you who have charge over all this world, we give ourselves to you. We're in your hands. I felt a sense of release, not from danger, but from fear. The Lord was in control. There was some noise from downstairs. I heard the garage door close and my van drive off. They stole that too, and then there was quiet. Nothing but quiet. I called out softly from beneath the pillows. Is anybody here? Who's here? John said, I think they're gone, Dad. Don't anybody move. They could come back. I sat up so I could hear better while I worked my hands free. John was freeing himself. John, I said, when I was sure we were out of danger, help everyone get loose and we can get out of here. I was so glad to see that everyone was okay. All I could think about was getting everyone out of our house and safely to the neighbors. We all hurried downstairs. We ran to the neighbors where I called the police. Surely I was back in control, but with the knowledge of who was really in charge. I was merely his deputy. I was amazed and thankful that God was in full control of our lives. First, he protected my family, and the next morning, well, I can still hardly believe what happened. After we gave our police statements, we went to stay with my wife's parents just a little more than a mile away, since the crime scene at our home was still being investigated. By morning, I was wishing I had the means to catch our assailants. I was on the phone when my mother-in-law said that there was a police car in front of our house. The house. John and Bo looked out the window and saw a police officer frisking a young man, and both at once shouted, Dad, that's one of them! Right in front of my in-law's house, one of the robbers had been pulled over by the police for a completely different offense. Soon all of them were arrested and most of our stolen property was located. They pled guilty, sparing us the ordeal of a trial. There was so little evidence in our house. They would probably never have been caught at all if it hadn't been for what some might call the coincidence of my son spotting one of them. That's not the kind of police work you can train for. That is God's work. What am I saying? You and I must never forget God is on the throne. And the fear of man brings a snare, but whoso putteth his trust in the Lord shall be saved. If that family, anyone in that family, especially that father, had just freaked out at the wrong moment, there could have been a mass murder there. As it was, God spared everybody's life, and God on the throne looked down and said, I'm going to take care of this right now. And God will take care of our fears as well if we will never forget that we fear Him and respect Him above anybody or anything else. Would you bow with me, please?